Europe in my backyard.
L'Europa in casa nostra.
Europa in mi casa.
Un'inchiesta radiofonica sulla politica di coesione europea.
Radijsko poručanje o evropski kohezijski politiki.
Europe in my backyard.
Radio reporting.
Un'inchiesta.
Radio reportage.
Un espacio radiofonico sobre la politica europea de coesión.
Az európai kohéziós politika nyomában.
Radio reporting.
Radio reportage
on European cohesion policy.
Über die europäische Kohäsionspolitik.
I'm Paula Wiseman, and over the course of the following weekly programmes, we're going to be hearing about the many ways in which European cohesion policy impacts us on our daily lives. So today, I'm lucky enough to be joined in the studio by Michael McGrath. He is the Assistant Principal Officer for the EU Structural Funds and Cohesion Policy Unit. And I'm also joined by Kevin Lynch, the Head of Animation at Colosse de Dulig College of Further Education here in Coolock. So welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Cool. So let's start with you, Michael. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the department? What is the EU Structural Funds Policy Unit? What's the kind of the overall...
What do we do and who does what?
Yeah,
okay.
Pretty much.
Or, no, or you want to say, who's got the money and where do they? What do they do with it? Okay. The Department of Public Expenditure and Reform is the government department that has primary responsibility for cohesion policy. I'll just park that. It has specific responsibility then for one of the individual funds, the European Regional Development Fund, and also has an involvement with one of our cross-border funds, Peace Plus. Now, I always said cohesion policy, what's that? But you said structural funds, and then you're talking about ERDF. And this is one of the things that, that starts with this. It's for people involved, they know all the names,
yeah,
they know all the language. For somebody on the outside, it's a case of, would you mind explaining what the difference is and what they do? Cohesion is what it's all about, and cohesion is about eliminating disparities across all the regions of Europe. It's from the very, it's one of the very, very founding funds and supports that the European Union is built on, and that's between member states and within member states.
Mm.
So it's trying to bring everybody up to, and bring us all together. So that's what the cohesion is. But then, how does it happen?
Yeah.
What does it do? So I'll start and then you stop or ask any questions.
Yeah, go on. But
it's almost like a tale. So the cohesion funds are there. They're the largest single part of the overall EU budget, making up slightly over a third, about 33% to 35% of the total budget of 1 trillion. The funds are allocated on a 7-year basis. There's a big complicated discussions about setting the budget and then how it all gets divided up. And the net result of all of that is that each individual member state, based on the needs of the regions and their individuals and things like levels of unemployment, educational attainment,
yeah,
remoteness, get a certain amount of money. So they're the cohesion funds.
Wow. So it all sounds pretty complicated, doesn't it? But, you know, I suppose to the layman, you know, to Joe Soap, it's kind of, you know, even to me coming into this, you know, hearing all these, the ERDF and all these different terms for all these different policies, you don't realise that there's this kind of like this force that's putting all this money into, you know, stuff that we kind of take for granted.
There is. And I think previously in Ireland, there would have been a lot more awareness of the actual direct impact of the funds without going into the details of them. But they were able to do different things. They were larger in absolute and in relative terms. So we could build roads, bridges, hospitals, schools, houses. You saw physical infrastructure being delivered where there was none. So, and you saw all this, you can still see the signs and various buildings,
yeah,
and everything,
yeah,
else. This is co-funded by under EU funds. Now, as we've become more developed, we get smaller amounts of money. Smaller, but they're still important. But they're not directed at those highly visible and easy to see things.
Yeah.
They are more developing skills, higher end, promoting research, helping with environmental adjustments. They are in training, development, people, investing into people. And that's why it's a bit maybe harder to see, but it is still important and it brings large benefits to us.
Yeah, so I mean, how many different, it's probably a very, very vast question, but how many different funds are there? Or is it just, there's just...
In the beginning, where will we start?
Okay,
the quickest way of saying it is, there are two big groupings of funds. One are direct management funds. These are funds looked after by the European Union and delivered directly.
Yeah.
Things like Horizon and stuff like that. We don't need to worry about those.
Yeah, yeah.
The main ones, when we're talking about cohesion and structural funds, you're talking about shared management funds.
Yeah, yeah.
There are primarily 8 of them, and they are grouped under one big regulation called the Common Provisions Regulation.
Right, right.
Now, who are they? What are they? Let's go. And there will be a test at the end of this.
Oh, don't ask me any questions.
There are the traditional structural funds. These are the ESF, uh-huh. European Social Fund, and the European Regional Development Fund. What you might essentially break them down is ESF is about people and training and supports for individuals and social causes. ERDF is more the science, the research, support from SMEs. That's very simplistic, but that's what they do. The Cohesion Fund itself is a specific fund for those member states that are less developed than others, that are 75% below the average GDP, and they are allowed extra money and extra resources because they're the most deserving, and they can spend that money on the roads, the bridges, the schools, the more hard infrastructure to bring them up to the European, closer to the European average.
Yeah.
Then we have the European Just Transition Fund, which is to help those areas most directly impacted from the move away from carbon. In Ireland's case, it's more the peat, so it's focused primarily in the Midlands. We have the European Fisheries Fund, focused up, again, coastal communities. And then we have 3 funds grouped together called the Home Funds. They're the Asylum Migration, which is kind of slightly a bit more topical than it would have been of late. We have the Internal Security Fund, and the thing referred to as the Border Management and Visa Instrument.
Yeah.
Now, that is one that we don't have to worry about because it is for Schengen member states only.
Mm-hmm.
The Cohesion Fund is one that, due as our level of development, we also don't have to worry about. So how many funds are there? In Ireland's case, there are 6. And what does all this mean for Ireland Inc? It means that we get, for our 7 years, the 7-year 21-27 programme, a total of 1.282.5 billion euro spread across those programmes. And that's what we get from the European budget.
Yeah, yeah.
But then deeper, now this is where Department of Public Expenditure and Reform comes back in, most of the programmes are delivered initially in partnership with government departments, who then fund other agencies that pass the money on to the individuals and the community groups and the researchers and the SMEs. So to access this money, you have to match it, you have to match it up. So you have to put money to it. So that's where DEEPR comes in as well. So for the previous round, for 14-20, for every 1 euro you got from Europe, the Irish taxpayer put up 1 euro to match it.
Oh, right. Okay.
So now that balance has changed slightly, but really when you take that 1.2 billion you include some other expenditures on other cross-territorial programmes, the total value comes up to around 3.5 billion of actual expenditure on the ground over the 7 years. So I know I said at the beginning that the money has become smaller and relatively less important, but it is not insignificant, and it is still there, and it is still delivering for the Irish taxpayer and for all our EU citizens.
Like, you're like, what was it before? Do you know what I mean? It's
back in the day, there was a time when people who remember the old Irish pound, God bless it, you were looking at 13 billion for Ireland Inc.
Yeah.
Now, what that represented, a much smaller European Union. Also, the fact that it was compensation for Ireland, Spain and Portugal when they created the single market. And all of those countries were remote from the market. They were distant. And they were very, very less, markedly less developed than the others. So for that reason, that's why you had the big money delivering infrastructure, the roads, the bridges, the houses.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do they make the decision as to, there must be so many people that apply for this money. And I mean, obviously not every project or whatever is going to get funded. So, I mean, how do you go about choosing projects?
This is where the entire infrastructure comes in on delivery, and people sometimes criticise EU funds for being very, very hard to access and to get because of the procedure. And I'll say one word before I say why and how it's delivered. On the other side, one of the main reasons for the bureaucracy associated with these is because it is taxpayers' money.
Mm.
It is citizens' money.
Yeah.
And the European Union more than are very, very cognizant of this. They're very protective of it. And they want to ensure, before they were very careful about how the money was spent. Like, you spent money, we gave you 10 euro, did you spend 10 euro? But now it's a case of, we gave you 10 euro. What did you do with the 10 euro? Yeah. What did you say you were going to do with it? What did you deliver? What did that 10 euro, 100 euro get? So for now, that's why there's an entire structure, mainly through managing authorities, that are assess projects, decide where the money goes and who gets it. Now, in Ireland, the ERDF is managed by the regional assemblies. The Northern and Western Regional Assembly look after the ERDF programme for the northern and western part, and then there's one joint programme for the southern and the eastern and the Midland region together, and that's based in Waterford. They are the first call, they are the deciders, they set the eligibility criteria, they draw up a programme at the start saying, this is our vision.
Right, right.
This is within the overall... one step back. The European Commission and the negotiations set an overall initial vision.
Yeah, yeah.
And that comes down to five kind of overall headings: a smarter Europe, a greener Europe, a more connected Europe, a more social Europe, and a Europe closer to the citizens. Now, in Ireland's case, most of our resources tend to go towards the smarter, the greener, and the more social Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
And within those kind of parameters, then a programme is drawn up for each region and for each fund. And that's when the managing authorities that are appointed for the funds, they set the rules, eligibilities, criteria, what they plan to do, what they want to do. Do they want to spend a lot of it on SMEs? Do they want to spend a lot of it on research? And then they will find bodies to filter through. So ultimately, some SME applying for a grant, research grant, will go through Enterprise Ireland or their local LEO office. But the money will have been decided that it should back up a certain type of investment, and that money was put to their local LEO or the local Enterprise Ireland office, and it's through there that they will get their money. On the social side, it will be through the ESF, Department of Social Welfare, or education that the funds are delivered. They're the primary, the primary ones.
It must be so hard, though, you know, all these deserving, probably very, very deserving projects, you know, as you say, building bridges and railways and roads and, you know, and that amount of money as well. You kind of think, you'd like to think that all of these projects could get something from it.
And this is where we get lost. We get lost. This is where you go lost in bureaucratic detail.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one of the things is you want to support everybody. You want to get a little bit of money everywhere.
Mm,
and for especially for small organisations, small amounts of money are very, very important. And some of that does go through, primarily through LEADER would be the best example of how that money gets out to the smaller community groups that it can do an awful lot with it. But also, one of the tricks, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. While we're given all this money and while you're given lots of options, one of the concerns is that it doesn't get too diluted.
Yeah.
Part of the other side of the rule is it needs to be thematically concentrated into certain areas. So they also kind of say, we want you to focus on a number of specific areas, tell a specific story, have a specific kind of intervention logic for your programme, and stick to that so that you can have a result at the other side.
Yeah.
So that's one of those ones you're kind of going, you'd love to help everybody.
Yeah.
The programmes would love to spread the money out, but then there's a case of if you spread it too thinly over 3 years, over 7 years, what do you see on the ground?
Yeah.
So that's kind of that horrible balance for the managing authorities when they're making those decisions.
Yeah, I suppose it's the results at the end of the day. Do you know what I mean? When it's all, everything's kind of said and done. Thanks so much for talking to me about that, Michael. And now we're joined by Kevin Lynch, the head of animation at Colossus Dulig, just down the road from here in Coolock. So welcome, Kevin. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks a million.
Fantastic. So do you want to start off by telling us a little bit about the... you're funded by Springboard. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the animation course?
Yeah, so we have a 4-year animation course at Colossus Dulig, first year QQI foundation year, and then a 2-year HND course. And then after that, we have a BA top-up, which is in association with the University of Wolverhampton in the UK. The top-up is running, I think, 7 years maybe.
Mm.
And we applied for Springboard funding, I think, in 2016 and 2017. We eventually got it. We got it in 2017 for the course. And it just meant that students who were accepted onto the course had their fees, you know, they didn't have to pay their fees.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've been awarded the funding since. So we've put in the application just there, I think, in February, and we're waiting to hear back. So we have to apply for it every year. And it's quite a long process. There's quite a lot of bureaucracy involved. Actually, they've simplified it a little bit this year. It used to be more complicated. This year was a little bit simpler. But we have to apply for it every year. So there's no guarantee that we'll have it next year, I guess, is one thing that I need to say, just in case we don't get it. But obviously, very, very hopeful we will get it next year. That means a lot, like, from a financial point of view for students applying for it. So it's open to kind of job seekers. It's open to people who are already in employment, mm-hmm. and seek to kind of upskill and improve their chances career-wise. And, it's open for people to coming back, you know, who maybe, homemakers and carers and people like that who want to go back into education. So we have criteria, though, of course, like, for students who apply for it. You should have, you know, a level 6 or alternatively maybe a HND or relevant experience. Mm. So there would be people, like, many people, for many years there wasn't degrees available at all in animation in Ireland. So there'd be a lot of people who maybe 10, 15 years ago would have come out of Ballyfermot or IIDT or even our own courses and wouldn't have a degree. So they are looking to come back. You know, they might be in full-time employment in the animation industry, and they'll be coming back to do our course, like, to get that degree, but also to give them space to do some of their own work, which they mightn't have the opportunity to do when they're working in a studio environment and they're just kind of working on, you know, TV production work or whatever. So it's given people, like, you know, it's given, like, all sorts of kind of people an opportunity to kind of come back into animation, to upskill and to, you know, to better their opportunities, like, in the workplace afterwards. So we're really happy with Springboard. It's been brilliant. It's really helped our course grow.
Yeah.
From it just being kind of our own students from HND going into, we've gotten a really diverse kind of selection of students and people who are extremely successful in their own right. Like, we have a BAFTA nominee on our course there 3 years ago. Absolutely incredible guy. He directed a Danger Mouse, and he was nominated for BAFTA for that, and he was coming and he was doing our BA, and then so, and that in with kind of, you know, 20, 21 year old students who have no experience whatsoever. It's a brilliant kind of environment for kind of for those guys to learn off these really kind of successful people, like, in the industry. So Springboard has been brilliant for us.
With the likes of, like, Brown Bag in Ireland at the moment, a hugely worldwide successful animation company. And I mean, I suppose a lot of your students could end up working for some of these guys. What sort of skills would the kids stroke people be learning?
In animation, it's quite a broad area, and people, like, I mean, typically people think of, you know, pencil and paper and cartoons, and then they'll also think of CG, computer generated 3D stuff. They'll think of, you know, the Pixar stuff or DreamWorks stuff or Disney stuff. So it's that and everything in between, really. Like, the Irish animation industry, Brown Bag is predominantly a 3D studio, mostly making 3D animated productions. So software which we teach on the course, like Maya, would be very relevant to anybody who wants to get into that. So they'd get very good at Maya, but even a very specific area in Maya, maybe just like rigging or lighting or modelling, you know. So you really do, there's so many specialists in the area, you know, there's so many different roles within an animation studio on a big production. Like, so, you know, to get kind of specialised, to get good at one specific area, like, will open doors for you, you know. And they're crying out for people that are specialised in these studios, and, you know, they're well paid jobs. There's also 2D animation, which is massive in Ireland as well. Like, we're doing a lot of service work for American production companies and making their shows here. Boulder Media was bought by Hasbro, the toy company.
Oh, right.
So they're basically now Hasbro's, you know, the arm for making animation for their toys. Like, so they produced the My Little Pony feature there, which just came out on Netflix there a few months ago. That was made entirely in Ireland. And there's loads of stuff, like that Danger Mouse show, which is a 2D production that Aidan directed, the former student. You know, that was made in Dublin completely as well. So loads going on. Of course, the big studio as well that we hear a lot of is Cartoon Saloon, based down in Kilkenny, and they've been nominated now for 3 times for Oscars.
Wow.
Brown Bag also have been nominated twice, I think, for Oscars. So like, that stuff really helps to put Ireland on the map as well, like with animation. Like, and it's kind of I think that in the conscious and people's kind of minds, like, animation is a thing now, you know. I mean, it is a thing in Ireland, it is an industry in Ireland, it does, you know, employ a lot of people. So there's a skills deficit as well, so that's why we're in the Springboard, we're getting Springboard funding, because they need skilled people, like, and they can't get enough of them in the studio, or in the studio system in Ireland. So that's where we're coming in. So we have industry professionals to teach on the course, and we've lots of kind of stuff going on. We just had our Keyframe conference there, where we invite loads of animation professionals to come in, speak in the college, do workshops in the college. And this year, because of COVID, it was just a 2-day event, but usually it's a week long event. And so that's brilliant for kind of, you know, getting professionals out, meeting students, for students to network, and also, you know, for them to kind of be aware of us, you know, for the studios to kind of go, oh yeah, that's Kalasha Dulig, like, I was out there. And so there's a lot going on, and it's you know, we're kind of, you know, as I said, we're delighted with our Springboard funding, and it's helped us a long way. It definitely has, like, and so we have 20 places every year with Springboard, and we hope to continue with that funding, you know. So it pays for the course, like, it's, I think it's about 3,700 euro to do it without the Springboard. So it's a massive help, like, to people, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what was your journey into animation? Was animation something that you'd always loved from when you were in school and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I love drawing. Like, I mean, I was good at art, you know, and I was kind of, you know, I would have been in school, I would have been, you know, one of the best in the class, like, in the art class, like, or whatever. But but like that, yeah, no. And so, of course, I, like, when I finished school, I, you know, I applied to lots of courses, and I actually, you know, I did a PLC in animation, and I went to IIDT, the National Film School there in Dunleary, I did a bit. I did production design as well, which is, you know, designing sets for TV and film, and so I worked in that for a while, and I got work pretty early on in Kalasha Dulig, like, doing part time hours, and I was doing my own stuff there. And then after a few years, they kind of, I went for an interview, and I got a full time position. So living the dream, you know. So I do a lot of my own stuff, you know. I've got stuff going on all the time, you know, which I enjoy, and obviously it's important to kind of keep, you know, to keep yourself, you know, your creative juices going, you know, to be kind of relevant, I guess, to the students, you know, as best you can, anyway. So
yeah, but I mean, it must be nice to be able to impart your own. Do you know what I mean? It must be you're kind of shaping lives. You know, it sounds really dramatic, but you're shaping lives at the end of the day. You know, these people could go on, as you say, they could go on to win BAFTAs and Oscars, and you know, no pressure at all, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's a privilege. I mean, I'm really kind of. It's not the kind of job you walk into and you kind of, you know, you're dreading it. Like, you know, you actually, you know, you're generally happy to begin into work. And the students we have are brilliant. I mean, there's something about animators, or the character of animators, that is just very decent, very nice, very honest, very genuine people. Like, you know, so our students are great, staff are great, and it is a lovely job, you know. Absolutely privileged to have that kind of that influence, maybe, on kind of young minds, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I have to say, Kalasha Dulig is just an incredible place. I was lucky enough to go do a degree in there a couple of years ago, and it's just, the staff are incredible. It's just a real kind of family atmosphere, and the teachers are, so, you know, like yourself, are fantastic.
Yeah. No, but of course, like, I mean, it's nice because the class sizes are generally quite small. And we'll never have more than kind of 25 in a class. And so, you know, it's a personalized experience. You know, students are looked after. Like, we know them all by name. Mm. And we know kind of a lot about them, maybe, you know. And we really do our best to get them through and get them over the line. It's a different kind of experience, I guess, in a university. You know, where you're kind of much more of a kind of a faceless kind of person in a big lecture hall. Like, it's a different kind of thing, and I think it's also a great place for our students. Like we kind of, as I said, there's a certain kind of students, like, who are very kind of interested in anime and comic books and animation and film, and you know, in school they're probably, maybe they're a little bit isolated, they might know that many people who are of similar interests, but they come to do, like, an art animation course, and there's, you know, suddenly they flourish, like, because they just meet so many people that are into the same stuff, and there's a great kind of college kind of, you know, spirit, like, particularly in an animation course, like, they're all hanging out with each other, they're all friends for life, really, like, from, you know, kind of their time in the college, you know. So,
very, very true. I mean, so let's kind of finish on talking about this funding. I mean, you know, the funding from Springboard, could the course operate without this funding?
It can and it will, but it will be more difficult. It'll be more difficult for students to be able to get the money. Like a lot of the people, like students we had, would be more from kind of more disadvantaged backgrounds. Wouldn't have the capacity to pay the money for courses. So I think it's really important that we continue to get it. And I think that the evidence is there that we are supplying the industry.
Definitely
getting people in. People are working, like, and the evidence of it there was in Keyframe. There, we had students who have left 2-3 years ago coming out to speak about, you know, their experience and that period, that transition period from college into industry, like, you know, and to get from college, because that's a difficult time, you know. How do you get in the door somewhere when you finish college? You know, you're suddenly out the door and you don't know what to do. So that kind of stuff was being discussed. But like a lot of our former students, I think of the speakers we had, 9 speakers, I think 6 of them were ex students, you know. So that's cool to see. It's really cool for our students to kind of they really relate to that, because they can put themselves in their shoes, you know, like a few years before. So
if anyone from Springboard is listening, you need to
please
put some money into the animation course at Kolos de Dulig, because they're just such a great, and listen, I'm only speaking from personal experience, but they're such a great organisation. But so thank you so much to both of you, Michael and Kevin, for joining me today. It's been absolutely fantastic chatting with you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So that's all from us this week. Thank you so much to my guests, Michael McGrath and Kevin Lynch. Thanks also to the production team, Dorothy Mayer-Holtkamp and Ed Grinnell. You can listen again to our interviews for this series at nearfm.ie/podcast. Or you can email us at europe@near.ie.
Europe in My Backyard is financed by the Department for Regional and Urban Policy through the European Commission.